From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and let's get more reaction to President Trump's decision to tap John Bolton to replace General H.R. McMaster as his national security advisor. Bolton is a former ambassador to the U.N., known for his bellicose foreign policy positions. Joining us now is Leon Panetta, former CIA director and secretary of defense under President Obama, and he was President Clinton's chief of staff. He's currently chairman of the Panetta Institute for Public Policy. Leon Panetta, welcome back.
Nice to be with you, Jeremy.
And what's your first thought about John Bolton as national security advisor?
Well, it raises some concerns because my view is that a president is best served by a national security advisor and a national security council that are willing to present a really diverse set of views to the president to make sure that he's well informed and that he makes decisions based on the facts and not emotions. And I'm a little concerned that that John Bolton has his own view, obviously a hawkish view of how to approach these issues. And the real test is going to be whether or not he's going to be able to present different views to the president, or if he's just going to present just the hawkish views of every issue that we're dealing with.
Well, and what do you think it means for U.S. foreign policy? The two areas that many have been focused on in the last day or so have been Iran and the nuclear deal and North Korea and the potential talks with Kim Jong-un.
Well, there are a lot of concerns because we're dealing with a lot of flashpoints in the war, in the world. I've never seen this many flashpoints since the end of World War II. You know, we've got a potential trade war on our hands. We're dealing with North Korea and a possible summit there. We've got China being much more assertive. We have Russia being much more assertive. We've got the Iranian regime and trying to deal with them and the nuclear agreement. And we've got cyber attacks. I mean, no matter where you look, there are serious crises. And the real question is whether or not those crises are going to create a situation that will involve the United States in a war. That's the concern. And obviously moving the National Security Council to the hard right, I mean, McMaster, Tillerson, and Mattis were a checkpoint here. Now it's going to be up to Mattis to be a checkpoint on some pretty hard-line views.
Well, and there are some questions about whether he might be next. Do you think that President Trump is going to stick with Mattis?
I hope so, because I think Jim Mattis is a solid individual who understands the world and understands the impact of military conflict and what it means. And so it's really important to have somebody like Jim Mattis in the room to make sure that the president understands what the full consequences of potential military action are all about.
Does this feel chaotic to you?
I have never seen the situation in Washington as chaotic as it is now, just because of not only policy decisions that are being made by this president, but the tremendous turnover that's taking place in the White House staff. You've got over 45% of that staff that is turned over. And when that's happening, the ability to try to make sure that there's some kind of stable consideration of the crises that this president has to face, it just makes it very difficult to conceive how that can happen in the midst of chaos and disruption.
Let's talk about another person who is going to be a new member of the administration, holding a job that you used to hold as head of the CIA. Gina Haspel, who's been nominated, she's the deputy CIA director. Now, you know her from your time as director, but she's facing tough questions about her role running a secret prison in Thailand where two terrorism suspects were waterboarded. What's your response to Haspel's critics who say confirming her essentially endorses torture?
Well, I would hope that the Senate, in looking at Gina, will look at her entire CIA career. Obviously, there are questions about her role at that point in time. I think she can respond to those questions effectively. They should certainly ask those questions, but I think they should also look at her entire career. She's a pretty dedicated CIA officer who, at least in my experience, always did her job and did it well. She knows the CIA and I think can do a good job, but it is important for the Senate to ask those questions because I think United States needs to know that they do have a CIA director who understands what torture is all about, but also understands what the responsibility of providing solid intelligence is all about as well.
Just a few seconds left, but another departure this week. John Dowd, President Trump's lead lawyer for the special counsel investigation, he resigned. What do you think that tells us about where Trump's head is when it comes to the Russia investigation?
Well, nobody quite knows where his head is at this point. He obviously wants to have an interview with Bob Mueller. I think that's fine for him to basically engage in that interview. There are lawyers that are worried about that. But I think, like everything else, this president is pretty much operating by his own instincts and by his own gut reaction to issues. And,
right.
You know, you can do that sometimes, but when you're president of the United States, you better damn well think about the consequences of acting based on instinct rather than the facts.
It's Leon Panetta, former CIA director, secretary of defense, and White House chief of staff. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Well, it's been a tough week for Facebook as it attempts to respond to the Cambridge Analytica data controversy. Facebook is facing some extreme criticism for not doing more to protect its users after it was reported that Cambridge Analytica gathered data from 50 million users without their consent. Let's get more on this and other stories trending in social media this week with Femi Oke. She's host of the stream on Al Jazeera English. Hello, Femi.
Hello there, Magna.
So, hashtag delete Facebook, have you?
No, it's my job. When I retire, perhaps. This is what one major engager on Twitter said. Very simple. It is time. Hashtag delete Facebook. This hashtag really went viral this week as there were more revelations about how many millions of Facebook users' information was out there to be used and perhaps abused without their knowledge. So Brian Acton said it is time. Delete Facebook. Brian Acton is a very well-known, famous computer programmer. He is the founder of WhatsApp. That one tweet was retweeted more than 12,000 times, liked more than 24,000 times. And that is certainly a position for many people who are on Facebook. But then the debate goes on. Luke Harms says, I will not delete Facebook. It is ridiculous to assume that your info is kept completely private on a social media platform that is designed to share publicly. Good point, Luke Harm. But then, again, this is the debate that's going on online, Magna. Ruth says on Twitter, it's not only about data privacy at this point. They have all my data. It's about supporting an underhand and at least morally corrupt app. I won't do it tomorrow. Hashtag delete. Facebook.
Huh, interesting. Well, I'm seeing here that Elon Musk has deleted the SpaceX Facebook page. Mm. So joining the bandwagon there. But, you know, Mark Zuckerberg told the New York Times that, quote, I don't think we've seen a meaningful number of people act on that. But, you know, it's not good. It's a clear signal,
yes,
that this is a major issue of trust for people.
I mean, understatement of the week, perhaps.
Yeah. And, I mean, look, but there are 2 billion Facebook users out there. How much could this snowball before it really does get Facebook's attention in terms of the number of deletions?
And also, it's interesting that people are doing this, having this conversation on Twitter and on Facebook, saying delete Facebook on Facebook, which is slightly ironic. If you really want to do it, this is what you do. Tread carefully. Go to your settings, go to a manage account, and then you can delete your account.
Yeah.
For good. It takes a few months for everything to disappear, but it is possible.
You know, it's interesting because this week all the attention has been focused on Facebook. I wonder if Twitter's sort of breathing a sigh of relief because the people have stopped paying attention to, you know, all the trolls and problems on Twitter. But Amnesty International has not stopped paying attention, right? They're calling out Twitter for still being a toxic environment for women, especially. They did an investigation. What did they find?
In the language of Twitter, Amnesty said, our investigation is called Toxic Twitter. They were looking at the abuse and the violence aimed at women online. And they did an extensive survey. It took them 16 months to do so. And some of the things are very hard to read out or even to read. There are trigger warnings on this report. So if you look at it and you find it on Amnesty, do be aware that there's some really violent language. For instance, bleep you, whiny bleep, women are all violent bleeps. I can't even read it out to give you some idea of what some women online and many journalists and many people who are just using Twitter as a way to communicate and engage are having to suffer. And so in the way of many amnesty campaigns, amnesty is saying, Twitter, just use your rules that you already have on board, enforce them and use them. And they're telling everybody to tweet at Jack Dorsey, the founder of Twitter, and ask him to enforce Twitter rules.
Well, Twitter says it's already doing that, right? I mean, they say abuse and hateful conduct directed at women, including direct threats of violence and harassment, are prohibited on Twitter, and yet it continues.
And they say they're doing this 10 times the number of abusive accounts at the same time last year. So they're saying, we are making progress. Amnesty saying it's not good enough.
And we've got about 10 seconds here. You want to say something about Cynthia Nixon?
Maybe Cynthia Nixon should say something about Cynthia Nixon. On Twitter, she announced that she was running for New York governor. People on Twitter are dubious and also enthusiastic.
Well, to be continued. To be continued. Femi Okeh, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Femi, it's always great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
All this week, we've been talking about bullying. Joining us to conclude our series is Emily Bazelon. She's a staff writer at the New York Times Magazine and a fellow at Yale Law School, and she wrote the book, Sticks and Stones, Defeating the Culture of Bullying and Rediscovering the Power of Character and Empathy. She spoke with Here and Now's Peter O'Dowd.
Normally, we have you on to talk about the Supreme Court, but you also have this expertise in bullying because you wrote this book 5 years ago now. What's changed in that time?
You know, what struck me when I was writing my book was how anxious and nervous and fearful a lot of people, especially parents, were about bullying. Partly, I think, because of the internet. We were still, as I think we still are, but more in an earlier stage of trying to figure out the effect of the internet on our children's lives. You know, none of us grew up going online and being on social media in particular in the way that our kids do. And so since I wrote my book, I would say that I think some of the anxiety has died down. It's become kind of more a part of normal life. But I think that the issue of bullying still is useful in the sense that it taps into people's desire to help kids in a way that cuts across all kinds of normal barriers. You know, bullying is a problem really for any kind of group of kids in the country. It cuts across race and class and where you live and gender. And so in a sense, it can kind of bring people together, although I realize that is a funny thing to say about such a hurtful problem.
Sure. And I do want to talk about the role of technology in bullying. But before we go there, let's talk about just big picture. How much of a problem is it in the United States? Are there figures on what percentage of kids are bullied at school? What do we know about that?
People have been asking questions about how many kids are victims of bullying or involved in bullying in some way for decades. So we do have data. And what it shows is that, you know, somewhere between maybe 15 to 20 in the low 20% of kids experience being bullied, if you define it in a pretty broad manner. And then you have another set of kids, a smaller set, but, you know, a fraction that bully other kids. And there are kids who experience both of these things, who sometimes act like bullies and sometimes are victims. One thing that's interesting about the data and surprised me when I was first learning about it is that the rate of bullying has not gone up. We see kids bullying in different domains when they go online, but it doesn't mean that the overall percentage of kids who are experiencing cruelty or harassment has risen.
So even with the rise of all of this technology and social media, you're saying that the problem is just as prevalent as it was before all of the technology. But what about the tech companies? Clearly, that is an issue that is at top of mind for them. I mean, are they doing enough to stop it?
No, they're not doing enough. I think that in some sense, it's hard to say what enough would be because they've created a platform in which bullying is so easy. And what I mean by that is that, you know, when people go online, they don't have the same cues to empathy that they have when they're having a face-to-face interaction. And they also can be anonymous. Mm. And then the kind of whole setup of how you push send or write a quick post online, that lends itself toward impulsivity, which is a particular issue for teenagers in terms of the way their brains develop. And so we've, in essence, designed a world by accident in which it's easy to be mean. We see that all the time online. And the tech companies, on the one hand, they have rules, right? It's not just like free speech, the way it would be if you were walking down the block. It's much more like being in a shopping mall where there are certain kinds of behavior and harassment that can get you into trouble. But that doesn't mean the tech companies really want to police for that kind of behavior. There is an overwhelming amount of data coming through their platforms. And so to a large degree, they have kind of sat back. They wait for people to make reports. They do or they don't follow up on them. There's a big gap between the rules that they have about harassment or hate speech and what they actually do when it's happening.
Well, plus you mentioned this key word, empathy. A tech company, how could they possibly help promote this idea of empathy online? It seems like a huge challenge.
It is a challenge. I mean, there are some things they could do. They have algorithms where they can promote certain posts over others. They could try to design an algorithm that, you know, looked for cruel words and move those posts down. Or even if they just saw that you were typing something, sent you a little note asking if you really want to send that insult to someone else, right? There are things they could do, but they would be changing the experience of using these kinds of platforms. And for the most part, they have been very reluctant to do that.
Well, First Lady Melania Trump met with tech industry leaders earlier this week at the White House, and she addressed her critics who've said that the First Lady is really in no position to talk about cyberbullying while President Trump uses Twitter to lob insults at his opponents.
I'm well aware that people are skeptical of me discussing this topic. I have been criticized for many commitment to tackling this issue, and I know that will continue. But it will not stop me from doing what I know is right. I'm here with one goal, helping children and our next generation.
Emily, what do you make of what we've heard from the White House about bullying?
You know, Melania Trump is trying to turn a weakness into a strength, but if she wants to do the most to address bullying, she should talk to Donald Trump about the example he's setting for kids, because there's no question that in some, you know, intangible way that is hard for us to measure, kids are affected by what they see adults around them doing. And when someone like Donald Trump uses incredibly harsh invectives on Twitter, kids see that a whole social norm is changing and that the way that adults in very venerated, dignified positions speak to each other sounds, you know, meaner than things they might say to each other in school. So, you know, there's just a problem here for the White House.
It's also a reminder that bullying is not just a problem for kids.
That's right. I mean, we've sort of all been treated to a couple of year-long lesson on bullying from Donald Trump. And one thing that strikes me over and over again watching Trump, and this very much translate to the schoolyard bully, is that when people try to stand up to him one-on-one, it doesn't work. They get dragged down to his level, and he's able to come up with insults that stick more than they are. The way that people defeat bullying is by banding together. It's by making it clear that you'll be shunned if you act this way and that nobody likes your behavior and that it's not actually a route to social power. We have not seen the Republicans in Congress. I think it's really Trump's own party that needs to play that role. We have not seen them doing that. And as a result, we have a bully who is changing our political landscape.
Well, so speaking of solutions, over the course of the series, we've looked at some of the things that people are trying to do here. We talked to a Sikh coalition about bullying that targets religious minorities, and we've spoken to a former bully who's now working with kids at school. I know you've looked into some programs to get a handle on this. What works? What doesn't?
What works is really when communities come together. So, you know, often when I'm talking about this issue, someone whose child is being bullied will say to me, like, what should I do? What's your advice for someone who's been a victim? And, you know, we can come up with personal strategies, but really the whole community needs to come together and send a message that bullying is not the route to social power. You know, when kids are asked, though, about bullying, do they like it when other kids bully? What do they think of this behavior? They almost universally say that they don't like it at all. And so when kids understand that other kids view what they're doing as repellent when they're acting like bullies, that really turns them off. That helps reduce the level of bullying in the community.
Is there a role for Congress or state legislatures here?
Congress, I would say not so much. I don't think we want to have a national law that seeks to address bullying because it really is such a local, granular issue. There are state legislatures that have tried to make sure that schools are addressing this problem, and I think that most of that legislation is well-intentioned. How effective it really is, I'm not sure. You know, we're talking about the most intimate kinds of human behavior, and adults are not especially good at intervening in kids' social lives. So there are just a lot of challenges here for how you can actually legislate the problem of bullying away.
That's Emily Bazelon. She's a staff writer at the New York Times Magazine, a fellow at Yale Law School, and she wrote the book Sticks and Stones, Defeating the Culture of Bullying and Rediscovering the Power of Character and Empathy. Emily, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
And we've been getting a lot of comments about this series on bullying, and joining us now to share a few of them is producer Chris Bentley. Chris, what have people been saying?
Well, we got a lot of reaction to our conversation about bullying among people of the Sikh religion. Simranjeet Singh heard it, and he tweeted, "Listening to this piece makes me appreciate how resilient the Sikh community is and how important it is for us to transmit that trait to our children." Gabrielle Aquino writes on Facebook, "The issue is unchallenged white supremacy, toxic masculinity. These men are ticking time bombs because no one taught them how to process their emotions, not just because they were bullied."
And the Sikh religion dealing with bullying a lot more than many others because of the dress that they wear. A lot of people shared their personal stories with us. What did they say?
That's right. One of them was Ben Opie. He writes, "I was bullied by a group of classmates, mostly in elementary school, though it followed me through high school. I can remember the first and last names of my core fourth grade bullies, but couldn't name for you another classmate. When you're on the receiving end, it stays with you. I have no idea if any of my tormentors feel any remorse in retrospect. If I had to guess, probably not. It was just an amusement for them." And Catherine Gogol left this comment here at nod.org. "Schools should incorporate a monthly session that helps children and adults, the teachers, administrators, janitors, etc., have confidence to stand up for themselves and others. As a schoolgirl, I often stood up for others. I was not one of the popular pupils, but I had a sense of what is right and not right. I would have benefited from guidance on how to deal with bullies."
So some comments there. You can leave more at hereandnow.org. Producer Chris Bentley, who also, along with Rachel Finlayson, produced this series on bullying. Chris, thanks.
Thanks a lot.
Global markets are trembling again today. Stocks around the world have fallen in response to President Trump's announcement that he plans to impose $60 billion in tariffs on China. The U.S. also launched a formal complaint against China's intellectual property practices at the World Trade Organization today. Meanwhile, China is retaliating. It announced its own tariffs on U.S. goods in response to President Trump's earlier measures on steel and aluminum that go into effect today. Mike Regan is senior editor at Bloomberg News, and he joins us now. Hi there, Mike.
Hi, Magna.
Okay, so this market response, I mean, are they responding as if a trade war is underway?
I think it's a lot about what they expect this could possibly balloon into. I've seen a few financial analysts refer to game theory and trying to figure out how it will all play out. And that sort of really speaks to the uncertainty surrounding where it could go next. That's this common cliche that markets hate uncertainty. But there's actually a lot of truth to that cliche. And I think we're seeing a lot of that play out in the markets right now as people try to figure out, you know, exactly how far each side will go in this trade. attention.
Okay, well, what about some specific industries then? I imagine U.S. agriculture isn't too happy that China is proposing tariffs on fruit, nuts, wine, pork, that kind of thing.
Right. Yeah, agriculture is definitely one of the industries most at risk of retaliation. So we've seen stocks like the tractor company Deere get hit. But agriculture is not a huge element in the stock market. What's interesting is that the recent weakness in stocks has really been very widespread among many multinational companies, you know, financial companies, raw material producers, technology, industrial companies, all got pretty beaten down yesterday. Boeing specifically has been threatened for retaliation, and its shares have taken a beating. And some of the big industrial companies like Caterpillar and 3M were very weak yesterday. So it's pretty widespread, the damage that was done yesterday.
Okay, so in that case, I mean, could this be enough to maybe put the brakes on this almost decade-long bull market we've been having?
Hey, you know, it's hard to say. I mean, I think the speculation is that President Trump is so proud of the progress the stock market made under his term that would sort of restrain him from being too aggressive in these protectionist measures. But that's yet to really seem to faze him yet. He seems to have taken the weakness in the stock market in stride. So that's sort of surprising to a lot of people, I think.
You know, I have to say, though, that the Trump administration going after China for what it sees as intellectual property issues or Chinese malfeasance on this front, I mean, they actually have an argument to make, don't they? In this case, it seems to be more of an issue with something that China's much more worried about than, say, you know, the Trump administration's argument on steel or aluminum.
Yeah, I think there is certainly a case to be made on the president's part that China has very lopsided policies towards the rest of the world. So, you know, ultimately it could be the type of thing that the World Trade Organization takes up and decides. But for now, it's very much, you know, a lot of tension about exactly how aggressive China will be in responding. And a WTO case could take a long time to resolve. So there could be a lot of uncertainty in the meantime.
Mm. Well, Mike Regan is senior editor at Bloomberg News, talking us through maybe something that looks a little bit like a trade war between the U.S. and China, or at least the markets are maybe reacting to it as such. Mike, thanks as always.
Thank you, Megan.
There's plenty of reaction to President Trump's decision to name former UN Ambassador John Bolton as his new national security advisor. In South Korea, the head of Parliament's Defense Committee called the appointment worrisome because it comes ahead of an expected meeting between President Trump and Kim Jong-un. There's also been a negative reaction from Iran because Bolton has called for the nuclear deal there to be scrapped. Jim Walsh is here and now security analyst. He's with the Security Studies Program at MIT and joins us in the studio. Jim, what do you make of this news?
Well, I'll put my cards on the table. I've never been a big John Bolton fan. He's someone who, over many, many years, has said, always been a shoot first and ask questions later when it came to foreign policy. He's advocated not simply revoking the Iran deal, but regime change in Iran, as well as carrying out a military strike against North Korea. So those are troubling views, and I think, and of course he had supported the war in Iraq and to this day still thinks that that was a good idea. So there are a lot of disagreements there. He, to his credit, he is well regarded as a skilled bureaucratic player, a smart guy. Mm-hmm. So there are pluses as well as minuses. I guess my overall reaction, though, is we seem to the president is moving away from any sort of model that might be a Lincoln team of rivals to one more of group think. He wants to find people he's comfortable with, people he thinks are going to agree with him, and that can work, and it can be a disaster.
Let's listen to Bolton here on Fox News last year talking about President Trump's options regarding North Korea's nuclear program.
You're down to two choices. Eliminate the regime through reunification or through coup. That's sort of a second best solution in my view. Or eliminate the weapons. That's what it comes down to.
We're just, you know, a matter of weeks away from a potential meeting between President Trump and the North Korean leader. What do you think John Bolton's appointment means for that?
Well, I think it reduces the likelihood of a diplomatic resolution. But at the end of the day, the president is his own man. You know, and one of the questions will be, how long will Mr. Bolton last?
Right.
As you pointed out, we're number three now.
Already lost two national security
exactly.
advisors. Yeah.
And so I think he's very skilled at interpersonal relations. He's reputed to be sort of a kiss-up, kick-down sort of guy. I mean, I think he got appointed because he gets along with Mr. Trump. But the president will make his own decisions. And then he'll have to sort of live with that. But what I worry about, stepping back from, you know, a person's policy preferences or their ideology, is just sort of the chaos of the thing. I mean, even before all this started, we had lots of empty chairs. We didn't have an ambassador to South Korea. We didn't Right. have a confirmed assistant secretary of state for Asia Pacific. Now we have new secretary of state who hasn't been confirmed, and we have a new national security advisor who's joining, you know, a month before the sit down. So lots of moving parts, lots of chaos here. That is not the ideal situation that you want to go into a negotiation with.
What about the Iran nuclear deal? Is that just done at this point?
Well, I'm reluctant to predict it, but I would say certainly the consensus is that the president has surrounded himself with people who agree with him that right. the deal should be ripped up. So let's think about that for a minute. What does that mean? It means it gets ripped up, and then the Iranians get to vote. They get to decide how they handle it. So the U.S. will have isolated itself, and maybe the Iranians will stay in the agreement just with the Europeans and the Russians and the Chinese. But there will be a hard push in Iran to resume enrichment. And if they do resume enrichment, there will be a hard push within the White House to respond to that with the use of military force.
What about Bolton and Russia and President Putin? Is he likely to influence President Trump in one way or another on that issue?
I don't think so. I think the president has what appears to be strong views there. He hasn't been moved by previous advisors. I don't think he's going to be moved by this advisor.
Do you think that Bolton agrees with him on Russia? Would have congratulated President Putin on that 75% victory?
No, not at all. He's long been a critic, as I have been, of Putin and of Russia. But my guess is, because he's a good bureaucratic player, Bolton will pick his when he's going to agree and when he's going to disagree. And he probably isn't going to disagree when he thinks it's a losing cause.
So just in the last few weeks, we've lost the Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, the National Security Advisor. There is talk about James Mattis, the Defense Secretary, maybe being next, or John Kelly, the Chief of Staff at the White House. What do you think all this means for American foreign policy?
Well, I think it's confusing to our allies. I think our adversaries probably see it as an opportunity to act and get away with things while we're dealing with our own internal chaos. I think from a governing standpoint, it's not very good. I mean, at the end of the day, yes, the president should have people that he feels comfortable with. That's the best, usually the best way to organize things. But this constant churn makes people scared about their job. It's hard to have a committee meeting when half the committee members are absent or unappointed. I think just the process of governing becomes more difficult, and you're not going to be as well prepared for those moments like negotiations or moments of crisis that you're not expecting that inevitably happen in an administration. So from a governing standpoint, it's a little concerning.
Let's hear now security analyst Jim Walsh with the Security Studies Program at MIT. Jim, thank you.
Thank you.
Racial and economic divisions sparked unrest in many American cities in the 1960s. Now a documentary film crew is taking a closer look at one violent uprising in particular, the 1968 Glenville shootout in Cleveland. There are different accounts as to what exactly happened, but the filmmakers say they want to make sure the whole story is told for the next generation. David C. Barnett from WCPN IdeaStream reports.
On July 23, 1968, a gun battle erupted between police and members of a black nationalist group in the Cleveland neighborhood called the Glenville. But just who shot first and why is still in dispute, although most media accounts at the time said it was pretty clear-cut.
It was almost like another Pearl Harbor, as a group of crazed militants let loose with gunfire on police. When it was over, 10 persons were dead, including 3 officers. Now, Fred Ahmaud Evans, the leader of the militants, goes on trial in a few weeks for murder.
But the television news narrative of a shootout on city streets, followed by looting and property damage, misses the story as experienced by community members. Yahya Abdusabur and Khalid Samad were teenagers that summer, walking along the same streets. It's easy to remember the chaos of 50 years ago.
This whole area was involved in the shooting.
Police officer rolled right up on us and pointed guns at us. You know, I mean, I thought we were dead.
Such personal perspectives are being captured by Paul Sapin, an England-based filmmaker who spent his teenage years in Shaker Heights. It was his father's connection to the Glenville shootout that brought Sapin back to Cleveland.
He was in advertising, and a number of people felt that the trial had been unjust. My father was approached to see if he'd help them run an ad in the local press, highlighting some of these injustices.
George Sapin created a full-page ad that ran in the Cleveland Press while Fred Ahmed Evans awaited sentencing for his murder conviction. It pictured the silhouette of a black man in handcuffs, his arms outstretched over his head. Paul Sapin came across the image in a Google search last year.
Then that prompted for me a hunt. I became really interested in this idea of what had taken place, to try and see whether in the telling of this moment that we could get more than one narrative out there.
Helping Sapin on this quest is a group of community members who have no memory of what happened in July of 1968. The Cleveland Metropolitan School District put him in touch with Glenville High School teacher Shanita Horton, who is now supervising a crew of student researchers. Horton says the filmmakers are following their progress.
And it's turned into an actual course where they're going to get credit for it.
The students are looking through trial transcripts, newspaper clipping files, and speaking with residents to hear some of the personal stories behind the sensational headlines. For Yahya Abdu-Sabur, the community was a powder keg of frustrations that exploded 50 years ago.
The insurrection was due to not being employed or whatever like that. You know, people wanted to, a lot of them wanted jobs, you know, wanted to be able to provide for their families. That has serious impact on people, you know.
For the past 50 years, the residents of Glenville have lived with an image of urban decay and danger. Shanita Horton hopes that recent redevelopment efforts in the community will help turn that reputation around.
That's important to me because I've experienced a lot of negativity when people find out where I'm from and where I teach.
And she thinks the documentary project is another step away from that negativity because it's sharing voices from the community. For Here and Now, I'm David C. Barnett in Cleveland.
Earlier this week, doctors in some hospitals began using gene therapy to treat a rare vision disorder that can lead to blindness. The procedure, though, comes with a record-setting price tag, more than $400,000 per eye. And the first person to have the procedure was a 13-year-old boy from New Jersey named Jack Hogan. Here he is just before his operation.
I hope it will increase my daylight, so like I could see at night for longer, and peripheral vision, so I could play basketball. I could see a whole court.
Eric Budman is a reporter with our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. Hi, Eric.
Hey, Meghna.
So first of all, let's just kind of talk basically about what a gene therapy is and how it's supposed to work, right? Because in this case, we have some sort of engineered virus that's supposed to help Jack ultimately regain some of his vision?
Exactly. So Jack and other patients with the same condition have defective copies of a gene called RPE65. And what this therapy is supposed to do is use a virus to deliver a healthy copy that will override that gene and then start producing this protein that will help them see light correctly.
I see. Now, how do they get then this engineered virus into the right places in the eye?
So it's a bit of a complicated process because the retina is not just sort of out there for anyone to see and inject into. So a surgeon has to go in and create three holes in the white of the eye and then actually suck out the gel that fills the back of the eye and then create a little blister in the retina into which he's injecting the virus and gene therapy.
Okay, and you were able to watch as surgeons worked on Jack's eye?
Yes. I think it took the surgeon, Dr. Jason Commander, a little longer than he expected to find the right spot in which to make the blister in the retina, but he got it in the end. Mm.
Now, Jack is the first person to have undergone this new treatment, but others subsequently also had had the same treatment done on them. So, but nevertheless, it's still very, very new, right? And this is an incredibly expensive therapy, right? Almost $900,000?
Yeah.
So why is it so expensive?
I think it's very expensive because it took decades to develop, and because it's for a relatively small patient population who have defects in this specific gene.
So small patient population, long time to develop, but Jack's family was able to convince their insurance companies to pay for it?
So Spark Therapeutics, who actually makes this gene therapy, has agreed to talk to insurance companies directly. And so Jack's family told me that they just let their insurers and Spark sort of work it out. But Spark has talked about a few different ways to make this drug more feasible to access. So they've proposed insurance companies paying for it in installments. They've proposed selling it directly to insurance companies so that there isn't the middleman of the hospital. And those are just a few of the ways that they've talked about. They've also discussed giving a potential refund if the therapy ends up not working.
Hmm. But there was a moment, if I understand correctly, before Jack's surgery where the insurance company asked for some kind of unique proof that he had the specific genetic mutation that led to his type of vision impairment that the therapy would be treating, right? There was a potential hiccup there.
Yeah. The surgeon wasn't expecting this, but he got a call late last week from the insurance company saying, can you prove to us that these specific mutations in this gene are what's causing his vision impairment? And for one of the mutations, that was relatively easy, but another kind of error in this gene is actually quite rare. And so it was only by finding a pretty specific paper that they were able to move forward with it and get the drug shipped in time.
Now, people are calling this the first true gene therapy that's been approved by the FDA, sort of separate from the therapies that make some cancer patients have undergone, where they take cells from the cancer patient's body, modify them, and put them back. But, you know, I think we should step back for a second. How has this therapy done in clinical trials? I mean, is Jack hoping to achieve full vision?
I don't think people think of it as a cure, but there is the hope that people will recover some of the vision that they're missing. And the clinical trial results were generally quite good, although there was a very small number of people who actually lost some vision. So, you know, there is always some uncertainty.
I see. And how are Jack and his family doing now?
They're doing well. Jack's patches are off and he seems to be feeling good.
Do we know if he's seeing any better, or how long will we until we do know?
There's an appointment that they have that's about a month out that will start testing for those changes, because he still has to have the other eye treated next week. So it's not over yet.
All right. Well, Eric Budman, reporter with our partners at STAT. Thank you so much, Eric.
Thank you so much for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty along with Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.